Welcome to A Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture. I'm your host, Zoe Elena Moldenhauer. This podcast is brought to you by the Aerogram Center for Arts and Culture, where we delve into social issues seen in museums and in art collections today. Today's topic, New York City's Hidden Treasure. Joining me is Development Officer Alexander Campos and Educator Maria del Carmen Barney from the Hispanic Society Museum and Library, who will be speaking with me about the museum, its complicated history with its Washington Heights neighborhood, and ongoing work to connect with its predominantly Dominican Puerto Rican community.
Well, thank you, Alexander Campos and Maria del Carmen Barney. Thank you for joining me. Can you both introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, Zoe. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you. My name is Maria del Carmen Barney, and I'm an educator at the Hispanic Society in the Education Department.
Hi, Zoe. I'm Alexander Campos, and I'm the Development Officer at the Hispanic Society.
Well, and you are both here to speak about the museum in relation to the community of Washington Heights. I had the pleasure of interning under Maria and Ryan, who is not here with us, but both who took me under the wing over the summer. In July, we met in person to host workshops. Many people who participated said that they were unaware of the museum. Can you in full introduce the Hispanic Society of America and share some difficulties of being labeled a hidden treasure in New York's cultural and artistic hub?
Sure. If you want, I can go first. The Hispanic Society has been around for over 100 years. It was founded by Archer Huntington, and it opened its doors to the public in 1908. When you say we're a hidden treasure, it's true, we're not in the museum mile. We don't have the tourist foot traffic that you have on the Upper East Side where the Met is, or in Midtown where the MoMA is. We have a different type of foot traffic, and that's of our local residents. And being New York, most people do travel on foot, but being closed for construction has made it difficult because the longer you're closed, the easier it is for people to forget that you exist or that you have something to offer. But it's important that we do this. It's important that we undergo reconstruction for many reasons, principally because we need to protect the artwork, and the changes to the structure of the building will do that in terms of environmental conditions. And like I said, it's important to remember that the building is over 100 years old, and protecting the artwork is our number one responsibility.
In fact, there are actually three buildings that we have, and each of them are from the early 1900s, and they all require extensive infrastructure work, part of the non-sexy things of renovations, including mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems, which are outdated, just for the protection of the collection, which is key, of course, but it's also for the protection of our visitors and the comfort of our visitors and the programs that we offer to the public. The challenges of having comfortable and safe environments for people to enjoy the exhibitions, to enjoy our education programs, to enjoy our public programs, the visitor amenities overall. So there's a lot of issues that we are facing from the overall landscape or campus of the institution.
And the museum has been closed long before COVID. It's been closed for 7 years because of this construction.
I'm fairly new. I thought that the museum closed in 2017. So that's what I recall. So it's been, and we kind of reopened one of the main galleries right in the fall of 2019 when we finished the renovation of the main building, which is all done with the landmark building. And so these are landmark structures. So not only are there issues with the infrastructure, it's also issues of cultural heritage that we have to protect. So the roof was done at a great expense at the landmark standards, best practices. And we actually received a landmark award, the Lucy Moses Award for landmark preservation in the roof work. A lot of it's copper roof, a lot of it was handwork by craftspeople. So it's really a tremendous job. We were able to open up our Sorolla Gallery. It's called Visions of Spain by Sorolla, which is a permanent installation of 14 large-scale murals. And we opened that gallery in the fall of 2019 with a standalone HVAC system. However, due to COVID, we had to close it, and we haven't been able to open it due to circulation requirements, which we are working on now.
And in the meantime, we've been sharing our treasures exhibition all over the world, actually, while we've been under construction. So that's one way that we've been still trying to share a collection while the building itself is not open to visitors.
And we also been doing programs offsite. We have done lectures at different places. We've done lectures, special education has done specialized tours for groups, virtual tours. When COVID happened, we were able to pivot smoothly to increase our programming because we were already working kind of in the remote way. So that's been wonderful. So not only has this exhibition has been traveling, we also have been doing extensive loans to places with considerable amount of work. For example, we have considerable amount of work at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We're doing an exhibition at the Grolle Club on East 60th Street with our library collections, going to feature 100 rare books and manuscripts, maps and documents. And that opens this fall. And we also initiated activating our outdoor plaza, especially the one on Broadway, which is totally more ADA accessible. And we've had, well, at least we had two exhibitions already during COVID outside to address the fact that we are under renovation still. And during the time of COVID, we were able to open up a new gallery. It's a special exhibitions gallery on the first floor of our East building, again, off the Broadway Terrace. And the purpose of that gallery is to really present rotating exhibitions, both from our collection or showcasing contemporary art, or in conjunction with our collection. We had recently featured in the Heights exhibition from University to Silver Screen, which documented the development of the musical. And this fall, we are opening a sculpture exhibition. And in spring, we'll have some our works back from Treasures before it goes off on another tour. We'll be doing that in the spring. We're going to have a watercolor show in the summer. So we have planned exhibitions to bring people into the museum, but it's not a large gallery. It's a temporary gallery. It falls within COVID protocol. We're able to do that. I get permission from Landmarks. So we are making efforts to reopen slowly and surely and engage with visitors.
So everybody who's in New York does have an opportunity to see parts of the collection that are in other institutions, but as well on site, which is exciting. I enjoyed the Washington Heights exhibit there. A lot of people enjoyed it too, celebration of the neighborhood. So that kind of goes into my next question. The Hispanic Society has struggled with its image in its neighborhood of Washington Heights, predominantly Dominican and Puerto Rican community. People are not interested in art of the colonizers. You know, there's a number of people who are outside of the Washington Heights community who assume that the museum is a Latin American museum because of its name. How is the museum exploring terminologies like Hispanic, Latin American, Latinx to create public and educational programs to reframe the assumptions about the museum?
I was thinking, for one thing, we're not an encyclopedic museum. We have a narrower focus because the museum was founded out of the collection of one individual as opposed to other museums that are developed as the result of multiple collections being brought together under one roof. And the building itself was constructed specifically for this museum and its library. And at the time in 1908, the surrounding neighborhood was not what it is today. It's evolved over time. You, Zoe, helped us on a project. Some of the research you were doing showed that, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, there were Jewish, Irish, and Greek families. And then in the middle of the century, more African Americans and Puerto Ricans started moving in, followed by Dominicans in later decades. The idea that people think it houses Latin American art because of the word Hispanic in the name. Huntington, the founder, was mostly interested in artwork of the Iberian Peninsula. And that's the reason why most of the collection is of that nature. But over time, the museum and the development of the collection has evolved with a greater emphasis on acquisitions from Latin American countries. And as a museum, we house the artwork in a controlled environment, right? We try to control humidity, temperature, pollution to protect the artwork, but we also investigate it and we research it. That's the other side. The Hispanic Society is an anchor within the city for Hispanic art. So it's, to answer your question, it's our job to welcome people, not just scholars, but also voices from the community, including artists, to gather to create a space for them to have discussions about these topics. And with our new director has really pushed for the idea that that's part of our role as an institution is to create an environment for these discussions to take place. And an example being the artist panel that maybe Alex can speak more to, where we invited artists to speak about their commission for the murals of the exhibition, Latinx Diaspora, Stories from Upper Manhattan, was the outdoor exhibition that was in the terrace. That's, you know, one of the ways that we're trying to address this.
The name of the institution, Hispanic Society Museum and Library, or Hispanic Society of America, which is the official name. And we kind of changed the branding to museum and library because we want to make people understand that we are equally a museum and library, because society sounds more limiting, but unfortunately that's our legal name. So we go by, but we do go by Hispanic Society Museum and Library publicly. I think the again, like Maria pointed out, you know, we were founded in 1904 actually, and the word Hispanic in 1904 was quite different, had a different meaning. And it does in 2004, right? So 100 years later, it has changed. It's not in the sense of its definition, because if you look it up, it still means the same thing as what we're about. We're about art and culture of the Spanish and Portuguese speaking people. It goes from Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, all the way to Goa, India, to the Philippines, to Peru, which includes the United States, the Southwest, so forth. So it's kind of been our name. I mean, it's kind of been an issue, but it's our name. And we kind of try to present ourselves as embracing all cultures, Spanish speaking and Portuguese speaking countries. And the way we achieve interpreting this is by through programs, as Maria mentioned, our exhibitions, our panel discussions, our programming to engage contemporary artists who look at the collection and reinterpret it from a different perspective, make connections and lineages to the history of the Hispanic world. We really are, through our programming, making efforts to discuss terminology. Because even the terminology today is problematic, you know, Latin American versus Latino, that versus Latinx. You talk to any person of who is from a country that speaks Spanish or Portuguese, which is a long thing to say, will have an opinion how they wish to be referred to or as. You know, some people do not like Latinx. They think it's too simplified. Some people wish to be identified as where their heritage is from, to be Puerto Rican, to be Mexican, to be Ecuadorian. I'm not Latinx, I'm not Latino. I am Ecuadorian, I am Peruvian, I am whatever. So it's really no way to list 50 countries and say we are the museum of 50 countries. So Hispanic still is relevant. The word Hispanic is still relevant because it's all embracing, though it has a connotation that we all know about. So it's how you invite people to discuss those connotations is what's key to us. We were already trying to, you know, the museum and library, it's an anchor in the community. We want to see ourselves as a cultural hub and work with many different organizations in the community, both cultural and community related organizations. And we really wish to make the museum a, you know, visibility, but not just for the community. Of course, that's critical, but also the citywide, because the diversity of the city is beyond more than just Washington Heights.
I agree with Alex. One of our local artists that worked with the murals, you may have already spoken with him, Billy. But he, you know, he brought up a good point that what Alex was saying too, the word Hispanic, like it can embrace all cultures that are under, you know, the Latin American countries are defined by the official language of the country being Spanish. So the language is what binds us all together. But at the same time, I feel like I'm just repeating what Alex has said, that some people may want to be defined more by the specific country that they're from. And in a sense, what Carlos, the artist, was saying is that sometimes the term Latinx actually does the opposite and it covers that up, because using the term Latinx can do the same thing that using the word Hispanic does, sort of overshadow the individuality of the person. So there's two sides to look at it.
And the top is that we are not just, you know, again, we are a lot of our collection, a lot of our programming has to do with the Iberian Peninsula. Our name has to reflect its collection as well.
We spoke with Carlos last episode, and so that was really amazing to kind of pick his brain a little bit more and to really break down the terminologies that were used. now talking about the collection and how it's all encompassing. Alex, when we spoke beforehand, you were explaining recent resident changes to Washington Heights, that the neighborhood is no longer solely Dominican or Puerto Rican. How are you working to define this community in relation to the museum?
Well, I think that the fact that I think there's assumptions made about what the community is. You know, if you look at census, you'll see a large, yes, Hispanic community or Latino community, but it's never always only been that. There's been residents as historically from its beginning to be reappointed out, Irish and Jewish and African Americans. And so there is still those populations. And I'm curious to see the, you know, census. I haven't looked at them for 2020. I would like to see statistics. I believe, you know, all communities change. Every, you know, a museum is a living organization. Communities are living communities. Just because a community changes the people, we're still responsible. Our responsibility is still to have a conversation with the people, to serve the people around us. So it doesn't really matter at the end of the day who or what it is. What matters is that we find ways to have their voices brought to the table. And so even though there seems to be a shift in demographics, it's still mainly a Dominican community. By large, you know, we're talking, you know, over 60-70%, but it's, you know, things will change and we need to be ready to bring people to the table of all backgrounds. And I think that we are doing that with, again, our programming. Everything we do is bilingual, everything we print, we do education classes, workshops in public schools that are taught in Spanish and English. So there's a lot of efforts. We have artists to teach and show. So we are making efforts to continue bringing people from the community involved with us. We have focus groups with community leaders. We've had engaged meetings with local arts, other organizations. We're involved in working with other arts organizations in the community, inviting them to participate, to use our space when possible. It's an ongoing task. It's never ending, because even though there might be predominantly Latino now, tomorrow it could be something else, but we still need to embrace those, whoever lives around us, because that's our immediate community. It gives us a vitality to be open.
Also, a community or a person, and, you know, an individual is not solely defined by their race. People are multifaceted. And yes. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that we don't want to assume that we know what people's needs or desires are. And that's a reason why most of the artists we work with are from the community. And that helps, because they know, they're as members of the community, they know what their local neighbors, you know, what they need.
Our goal is really to bring people to the table and have them tell us how we could partner up and bring issues that are current and relevant to society to the table through the programming we do, through the art. Of course, all have to go back to the art and culture of Hispanic world. But we want people to challenge, you know, what we're doing. Why is this way? And we want to know why as well. There's no excuses here. We want to be open and have frank conversations about how do we deal with work from Spain in this community. You know, the museum was founded, like Marie said, in 1904. That's one train was built and opened to the public in 1904. And that was, I believe, 157th Street was the last stop before it went up. And Huntington saw this neighborhood as the next community to be built. And he wanted to bring a cultural organization to this community. So that's where he purchased the land and built the museum and library. And then he invited other colleagues, other philanthropists. He invited the Hay Foundation to open up the Museum of American Indian, the Numismatic Society, the American Geographic Society, and the Academy of Arts and Letters. And he actually provided support to have all these other cultural organizations built on that campus. So not only are we there, all these other organizations were there. He saw that as for the community. We are probably one of the oldest institutions in the city. We have a collection that's incredible with Zargoyas and Velazquez, El Greco's, many more than any other institution has. We have Soroya. Cunnington was working with contemporary artists during his period. He collected living artists of his time, such as Soroya and Suetlega. And, you know, he was really encouraging conversations with artists and engagement with the public.
Yeah, and I had a private tour of the Soroya exhibit, and on one of the pillars in the main gallery room, there's a poem. I forgot who it's by, but it's like inside the exhibit. We've all three of us were trying to read it without any lighting. And I think it was interesting to see that the director of the museum at the time had kind of let people come in and participate within the museum. And so it's like a permanent poem that's kind of scratched onto one of the pillars in the exhibit. Just a fun little treasure within this treasure.
Yeah, I remember we were reading that. Ruben, I can't remember the last name. But just like you said, like little hidden treasures within the building itself that reflect that at that time there were living artists being invited. So this is not just a museum that houses art from centuries ago. And so we're trying to continue that tradition.
And I think we are. Was, for example, that Latinx Diaspora exhibition we just had this past summer. It was very, you know, people walked along Broadway and who lived in the neighborhood and saw these fantastic large-scale four murals and walked in and into the terrace and enjoyed it. And we did, you know, audio guides, interpretations of the four murals, and both in English and Spanish, and with the QR code. So that was very, you know, important for us to have that there. And we are working with 10 artists now, contemporary artists doing research, are called the Artist Research Fellowship, supported by the Vilchik Foundation. And they are 10 artists who are all immigrants from different parts of Latin America. And they are looking at our collection related to their artistic practice. And hopefully, you know, we want to do it next year. We would like to do a series of artist chats or where they present their findings and connect it to their artistic practice. We also launched a new program called the Curatorial Conservation Research Fellows. We have four of them, and we want to thank the Rockefeller Brothers Fund as well as the Queen Sophia Spanish Institute for supporting this project. And they're basically paid internships for grad students and postgrad students. And they each have an interest in a different part of the collection, and they're doing research on the collection. And it's important that we found four graduate students or postgraduate students who represent underrepresented communities, and that they are being given opportunities to advance their careers. These are just two examples that we are doing during this time of closure, but we wish to continue them, of course. And of course, it's all based on funding. Funding is always key.
Yeah, and that actually kind of segues into my next question. So, you know, within the structure of museums, there's sort of a hierarchy between curatorial being valued above educational departments in terms of funding. With a museum that doesn't currently have a collection that's, you know, on tour while the museum's under construction, how might there be an opportunity for the education department to bridge and define community during this period of construction?
I remembered the name of the artist that we were talking about, Ruben Darío, that had written on the wall. Sorry for the interruption. But to answer your question, because of this situation, the education department really has the opportunity to expand outside of its traditional practices. We've been really reevaluating what it is that we have to offer our community, given our limitations, right? So one of those things is our space. We have a large outdoor terrace, and that's been a really good way for us to connect with the community. We held these in-person workshops with local artists where we invited the community to come out and make art with us. For our first workshop, and I know you remember, Zoe, you and I actually stood outside the gates and spoke to families. We invited them to join us, asked if they wanted to learn about mural making and come and paint with us for free. The idea that all of our education programs are always free of charge, that in itself is another way that we try to facilitate interaction with the community, because the founder wanted it that way. Above everything else, the founder wanted the Hispanic Society to be a place of education. So that's really central to our purpose. And during one of those workshops that we had, I remember a man came by and he shared his story with me. He grew up in the neighborhood, and he said that he and his friends used to skateboard on and around the terrace. And he said that that was where he and his friends hung out. And so that's what we're really trying to recreate. And our hope is that eventually the neighbors will view the terrace and the museum in general almost as an extension, if you will, of their own home in a sense, a place where they can gather regularly and claim their space, a place where they feel comfortable.
Yeah, I think, I guess, like I mentioned earlier, we really want to make the museum and library the cultural hub of uptown. We are one of the largest, if not the largest, cultural organization uptown. We also want to be a great good gathering place for everyone. I believe there is not necessarily a hierarchy. I think it's just basically the nature of the beast. The institutions of museums are founded for the presentation of art objects, you know, objects. So objects have been the key thing, what makes a museum a home for objects for people to come see. The exhibition in itself is an educational component. The information that we provide to the public in an exhibition is also an education component. A lecture or tour or whatever you do to the public is an educational component. So I don't think it has ever been a hierarchy. I think it's been basically how much more can you do to expand your engagement process. So I think that's necessary, that, and I think that's on everybody's mindset right now, from the curator to the director to anybody in the institutions, that we need to be more mindful and more vigilant in providing ways in which to engage the public.
Yeah, working as an intern, I've had the opportunity to see the behind the scenes and get to meet all the different type of staff, and I noticed that a number of them or Latin Americans, or have a background in Latin American studies. And I'm wondering how you both came to the museum and how you are navigating the politics of representation, either in your own work or through the museum as well.
I'll start first. I've been working in the museum world in New York City since 1987. So it's quite some time, over 30 years, whether it may be 35 years soon. I've seen museums from various different perspectives and different roles that I've played, from, you know, being in charge of creating art history classes and tours and taking people on trips across the country to see private collections and artist studios, to dealing with city politics and how funding is allocated to cultural organizations throughout the city, to being in charge of government and community affairs in the Bronx. So it's been an interesting career and challenge. And when I was thinking about my next step, at that time, I did not want to be another executive director again, because it's very stressful. You take everything with you every day and night, you payroll, cash flow, the leakage in the roof, it's everything, HVAC not working. So I wanted to take a break from that stress, but I still wanted to commit myself fully to an organization. There was, you know, a couple opportunities I saw, and the Hispanic Society is one of the institutions that I know of that I've always cherished because of their collection. Islamic art is one of my personal interests. So I saw the opportunity to work there, had the lovely opportunity to be interviewed by Philippe de Montebello, who is the chairman of the board, and I was hired. I'm not necessarily working at the Hispanic Society because I'm Hispanic. It just happened to be an organization that I've cherished because of its collection. And my responsibility there is to really find ways to support and engage the public.
The way I came to the Hispanic Society was I responded to an advertisement for an internship because my background is in art history, and I had the opportunity to work under the mentorship of Dr. Christina Domenech. She's the one who really built the education department from the ground up. So a lot of what I learned from her, and a lot of what that consisted of was building relationships with other organizations, grassroots establishments in our same neighborhood that work to represent our local community, that have the same mission in education, choosing to work with artists specifically from the area. Like Alex said about himself, my focus in art history is an Islamic art. And that's something that we have as part of our collection because of its relationship in the southern part of the Iberian Peninsula. But also speaking Spanish is something that I grew up with, and knowing Spanish is something that is really helpful if you work in this museum, you know, there's certain things that you need to kind of have under your belt to be able to do your job. And that really helps me to be able to engage with members of our community. A lot of our tours are programs for students. We do them in both English and Spanish, depending on what their request is. When you are talking about the politics of representation, I think this is a great question because being the Hispanic society, we are under a lot of pressure because this is a critical moment in history. And it is good to question yourself. Yes, of course, we have art from Spain, from the Iberian Peninsula in general, which includes both Spain and Portugal. And people have different expectations of our museum because of our location. That's something that we talked about earlier, but it's important to remember our origins by a single founder with a very particular focus. You know, as a result of police brutality and the pandemic, a lot of people are hurting right now. So we're just trying to stay open and listen to what our community needs. And I think the best thing that we can do is just create a space for discussions about this to take place and address these issues openly.
I also want to say that you mentioned, you know, how we're dealing with ourselves as Hispanic people working in Hispanic society, museum and library. I think it's wrong for people to have assumptions. Assumptions are really kind of problematic. People assume just because you're Hispanic, you're interested in Hispanic stuff, or Latino, you're interested in Latino stuff. This is a perception that's kind of misguided. There's many subtleties in all these aspects, and we need to not look at, make assumptions of what people need. We are, you know, as ourselves, to people who are not, who are Hispanic or Latino or Latinx, whatever word you want to call. We are, you know, we work at the institution because of its overall intellectual capacity and a commitment to engaging people. And that's our role. The donors I deal with are from all facets of the country and international. And so it's really about engaging people. And we have a diverse staff. I mean, I would say that it's, you know, it's 50-50. And a lot of our curators are Spanish experts. They all speak Spanish and write Spanish fluently, but they're not Hispanic. But they have an interest in Hispanic culture and art. And this is their livelihood. And for me, I'm interested in helping a museum. Like, I've worked in different museums. I'm interested in helping this particular museum because I think I contribute to helping them. I want to be useful to an organization. And I think this is an organization that I like intellectually. I like the collection aesthetically, architecturally. It's a fantastic facility in campus. And this is what draws me to that institution. I'm a trustee of a historic house. I like old stuff. That's me.
Maria, what you said a little bit earlier about your ethnicity not really being your identity, that everybody has their own interests, you know, that was really well said.
There is like this idea of intersectionality too. And so I think that plays a big role in that we can't assume that because, you know, a person is not just one thing. They're not solely defined by one thing. And we have multiple interests. Like Alex said, you know, being Hispanic doesn't mean that you only are interested in Hispanic art, or it could mean that you are, one is not dependent on the other.
Yeah. And what I appreciated in the short time that I've interned is how small and how easy it is to build that relationship with every member, you know, like Guru, who is the security guard, such a funny personality that he brings to the collection as well, so that everybody is bringing, you know, aspects of their culture, their identity in ways that are unique.
We are very small staff. We are like 20 full-time and 5 part-time. And that includes maintenance, security. And we have 3 built. So, and a huge collection, you know, I forget, 18,000 objects. 150,000 photographs. I forgot, 200,000 rare books, manuscripts, and modern books. We have documents. We have a tremendous collection. And the staff is all, most of the staff has been there a long time, very committed to the organization and to the collection. And they're very diverse, you know, people from Europe, people from the South America, people from the Americas, of different races, of different ethnic groups. It's not one thing. I think the nice thing about working at a place that's kind of has this, you know, people have this perception of it, Hispanic, yet the staff is quite overall embracing the many people of all over.
Something that surprised me was how internationally recognized the museum is in Europe, where it's not in New York City. And I'm curious how you are working to kind of bring that renowned notoriety back to New York City, back to Washington Heights.
Through our programs, as I mentioned earlier, and I think that we discussed some of them already, but for the, like, for example, the exhibitions, we are planning to do more contemporary art exhibitions or contemporary art exhibitions of conversation with our collection. It's important to keep that lineage together or create that lineage because it's not black and white. It's also through our residency programs, our meaning our fellowship programs, both for artists and for curatorial. It's about engaging with the public through our art workshop, art making workshops in the public schools or art on site. So it's through our programs that we really bring attention to the museum locally. And in fact, some of the workshops we do in schools are not just in the Bronx, South Bronx or Washington Heights. We have done workshops in Brooklyn. I know we did the math workshops 2019 before COVID happened.
Yeah, I would definitely say with our public programming, we had an outdoor concert series, a campaign to introduce programming for people of all ages, but in particular, gearing it towards the younger generations, as because the museum's been closed for a while, the younger generation doesn't have the knowledge that the older generation does of the museum. So in particular, the MAPS program, for example, which you were a part of, Zoe, it's a really unique way to use our 15th, 16th, 17th century maps to introduce middle school and high school age students to the museum itself, but also the idea of identity, mestizaje, and help them also to do some self-discovery of their own roots and use the collection to engage with the community in that way, specifically the younger community.
I really enjoyed helping with that workshop and expanding on it to talk about contemporary artists who are also exploring map making. It was amazing to sit in through those workshops.
What you, your role in that project was really critical too, because you helped bridge that gap for the younger generation to be able to make a connection with the work of contemporary artists that allow us to connect maps from 500 years ago to maps today, so that these students can relate something that's 500 years old to their own lives today. And so thank you for your work on that.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Even though our collection is very historical in its sense, we mentioned that Huntington himself was interested in dealing with artists directly. And this is now, you know, becoming a key interest of ours. It has become a keen interest of ours to engage with contemporary artists, not just through the workshops or through engagement that way, but also through our exhibitions. So it's really like the research fellowship that we have. It's really about having artists help through their voices bring attention to our collection.
My last question is, how can the museum pull itself out from under its legal bind? The museum can't charge for exhibitions, that it is an historic building, so that there have been reports on the museum looking for other locations, but they can't because built on a specific campus, other issues related to the endowment specifically. So where is the museum in terms of that process? And if not, how can the museum reach its community?
These legal issues are something that we brought on, in the sense that the board 2015 was trying to update our charter, our bylaws and so forth to make us a more modern museum. We were founded, like I said, in 1904 and left an endowment that had requirements that we need to fulfill. One is not charging, which is easy requirement to do. We don't charge for any of our programs or for our exhibitions. They're free in charge, always have been. One was the size of the board, which was limited to 5 people. We were able to change that to 25. And since 5, 7, 6 years now, we have 15 people on the board members from all walks of life. And we find it important for 2 reasons. Of course, for the fundraising, the larger board, the more vehicles we have for raising funds to do our programs, but also for their voices as governance of the institution. They are responding as well to the challenges all museums and libraries face, all cultural organizations are facing. And that's about engagement and dealing with the social problems that we're all facing as a society. So it's interesting to have these perspectives coming across the table from different levels. So we are dealing with those issues as best we can. We have three buildings, as I mentioned, and three outdoor spaces. It's landmark, they're old, and any care and any renovations to make them truly accessible, not just, you know, for those who could walk up and downstairs. We need to really focus on bringing in and engage with everyone from all walks of life. So we don't find the legal issues to be limiting, but more of an opportunity to figure out new ways of working and ameliorating our, what we do.
Yeah, an opportunity to be more creative. Of course, applying for grant, and we have a lot of wonderful donors that believe in our education program and our mission, but also just acknowledging why this was in place in the first place. You know, Huntington wasn't just someone that liked collecting to decorate his home. He was very much a scholar. Everything he obtained, he studied it, he researched it, he was enamored by the culture. It was so powerful, his passion, that he purposely did not want to take anything that was still within the borders of the Iberian Peninsula. He only obtained objects that were already been bought by other dealers in Paris, London, or already in New York, except for one library collection. But you can look at that two different ways. Yes, this library collection was purchased from a marquee within Spain, but at the same time, collections are tricky because you don't want someone else to go in and just piecemeal them, take them apart and start selling them off for the money, right? The collection is still intact because it was all purchased by one individual. You know, going back to answering your question, I just wanted to kind of give some background on why things are the way they are. But it's a good thing because it allows us to connect with our community by facilitating engagement, because people don't have to pay to come and see our collection. And that also means they can come as many times as they want in a year. You know, you're not limited by lack of funds.
And I want to say that the, you know, our concert series, our public programs are also free, and we get funding for that. But what makes it more interesting for me is that the people who actually become members of the institution of our organization are becoming members more from a philanthropic mindset, which means they are more committed to the institution because of who we are and what we have and what we do, as opposed to getting something in return, like free admission or discount in the shops or so forth. It's really about supporting an organization, a cause.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for speaking with me about the museum. I, again, want to just voice my appreciation for having the opportunity to work with the education department and to see what you've both been speaking about in action and to contribute in some small way.
Pleasure. And then, you know, you still could come back and intern again.
Of course. We would love to have you help us. You know, there's always room in the education department. But thank you so much for having us. And this has been great.
Yes, thank you.
This has been A Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture, a podcast from the Eric Graham Center for Arts and Culture. I have been your host, Zoe Elena Moldenhauer. Join us on our next episode, and in the meantime, visit our website at www.eragram.org or follow us on social media at Eric Graham Arts to learn about opportunities, events, and more for artists and writers.